what I would like to do, and I don't want to put Matt on the spot, but one of the videos was particularly about PrEP, also known as pre-exposure prophylaxis, and I thought, because Matt and I have both been meeting and working on PrEP in the context of Ottawa, we've talked a bit about that, and what else is happening in Ottawa, and if there's questions or comments or conversation, I can go from there.
Okay, sure.
So do you want to just explain what PrEP is? And
yeah, for sure. So hi, everyone. My name is Matthew Harding. I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator at Max Ottawa. We're an organization by and for guys who are into guys. And through my work at that organization, I actually have the privilege of coordinating somewhat the beginning of a citywide strategy for access and uptake to PrEP, which is a prevention tool that seronegative people can basically use to prevent HIV from establishing itself in their bodies. So yeah, in a nutshell, that's what PrEP is. And it's a very underutilized tool, I believe, of combination prevention within our communities. And it's offered as a new opportunity for us to kind of look at how we want to prevent, you know, and reduce HIV within our communities. So it's an exciting time, but it's also not a super comprehensive thing, and it's not the only tool I think that we should be looking at, but it's definitely offered as something that's new and interesting, and obviously because of the biomedical aspect of it, it's gaining a lot of traction, a lot of popularity. So does anyone have any question specifically about PrEP or that strategy or about what you've just seen? We can start there. No, okay. We'll give you a second to think about it. It's okay, take your time. We're in no rush. Yeah.
Thanks, guys. I'm curious just to hear more about the differences between like the particular campaigns we saw represented around criminalization, around homelessness, also access to PrEP, and how you see that playing out in Ottawa and Canada.
Yeah. So just speak to the criminalization question most specifically first. So in the US, different states have different specific laws criminalizing HIV exposure. So that is if someone doesn't disclose that they're HIV positive in any sort of sexual scenario, but you also saw they list biting, spitting, etc. Most of those charges haven't happened in the last decade or so, though the ones around spitting and biting are older, but they're part of a similar narrative of like HIV positive people are vectors of disease that are dangerous biological weapons, is essentially how it's framed. So in the US, there's actually specific laws around HIV exposure and non-disclosure. In Canada, we don't actually have any of those laws. The way that HIV criminalization works in Canada is actually conceptually it's sexual assault law, which says that if someone has not disclosed, then therefore they couldn't have consented to the sexual interaction that you've had with them, and therefore you assaulted or rate that person if you had sexual intercourse. So the contexts are very different, and I actually think Canada provides a bit of a cautionary tale because there's activists in the US who are, like the SARA Project in particular, are trying to get those laws scrapped, right? But in Canada, we've never had those laws, and Canada has one of the highest per capita prosecution rates and conviction rates for HIV non-disclosure in the world. And we don't have specific laws to HIV non-disclosure. I think that's a really telling difference between the US and Canada. I think one of the aspects from the videos that you also saw is it foregrounded the voices of African Americans because they're disproportionately affected. The same is true here. And in terms of HIV criminalization, we all know that racialized people are more likely to interface with the criminal justice system, if we can call it a criminal justice system. And so the people who have been prosecuted and imprisoned are mostly gay and black men, or gay black men in Canada. Yeah. Do you want to speak to PrEP and the difference between US and Canada?
Maybe you can start us off.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's generic PrEP in Canada. There's no generic PrEP in the US because the United States is a nightmare and it's all private healthcare, right? There is a generic version of PrEP here, and would you want to say the price difference?
Yeah, for sure. So in Canada, if you're looking at getting Truvada, a bottle of 30 pills will cost you about $850 without coverage, which is really high. And a generic version now is now, well, there's actually many versions of a generic that's now offered in Canada, and those range at about $250 a bottle. Bottle is about 30 pills. Depending on how the person chooses to use the medication, one bottle will usually last you about a month. Some people decide to use intermittently as well, which means they can use depending on depending on what kind of interactions they're having with people or when they feel they're at higher risk. It's not a highly recommended way of taking the medication, but it is a way for some people to, you know, use that really expensive medication for maybe a longer periods of time. But currently in Canada, that's what access kind of like looks like. There is actually not a lot of coverage. It's actually quite sad. We don't have a lot of political leadership to kind of change the field of how we see prevention and intervention. I think there's National Pharmacare, you know, that's still in the making. They're consulting. Feels like they've been consulting for 25 years. Like, when is it gonna happen? We want access to these medications for free. Not everyone can afford to buy them. And if we really want to reach those goals, then we really need that leadership at a federal level, but also at a provincial level. I think a lot of people have been left behind, and including, you know, seronegative people for not being involved in the conversation from the get-go to know how they can also contribute to this conversation from happening and how to reduce stigma, and how to be able to, you know, have positive relationships with HIV positive people, which is totally a thing that can happen. You know, science has been telling us, you know, this is the reality of HIV today. Why are people still, you know, thinking that it's such a negative thing or seen as, you know, a dying disease, basically. So I think, yeah, so I'm pretty much going a little bit everywhere here, but coverage in Ottawa currently looks like, you know, unless you have some coverage from your workplace, through private insurance, plans, or if you're newly arriving folk to Canada, so if you have refugee status, if you're Aboriginal, Aboriginal Indigenous, you also have access to medication for free through a federal program. If you're senior over 65, you may have access to the medication with OHIP Plus. Under the age of 25, you also have access. But yet again, these insurance plans aren't very well known, and a lot of people actually don't know that they exist or that they have access to this medication through these programs. And then everybody else in between can have access to like reduced costs through programs like Trillium, which will cover, you know, part of the medication cost. And same if you're HIV positive, we'll cover some of the cost of your medications as well. But as we see, you know, when you're on the ground really with the people, it's not enough. It's still too expensive. And if you cross the bridge over on the other side, they have RAMQ, which still costs about, you know, you have a deductible of $90 a month still to pay for your medication, which is a lot of money for some people. You know, it means maybe buying groceries for the last 2 weeks of your month or not, right? So, or other things.
Yeah. And one other thing I'll say about the Canadian context, just to be thinking about not just Ontario or Ottawa, but the epidemic looks really different regionally in terms of like how the virus is being transmitted and also who is living with HIV. If you're in the prairies, we're talking about like primarily Indigenous people. If you're on the coast, we're talking about primarily the behavioral category of MSM, which is men who have sex with men, which is a way to not say gay and to include people who have sex, men who have sex with other men that don't identify as gay. So the Canadian context is really interesting because you have to take into all those things into account, right? So the modes of transmission in the prairies is primarily through intravenous drug use, and it's happening amongst racialized and Indigenous people. And on the coasts, of course, that's happening as well, but the majority of transmissions are happening between MSM. One other piece I'll say about the Canadian healthcare system is wonderful. Coming from the US, I really appreciate having permanent residence here. But one of the challenges in Canada is that it's all provincially regulated, and so everything is different every province you go, so the quality of care you can get can look different. One example being, I've been working for the Canadian AIDS Society, and they launched a National HIV Testing Day last summer, which is sad and pathetic because it was launched in the US in the 90s and in the UK in the 90s and in Australia in the 90s, and somehow Canada doesn't do it until 2018. And part of it is because well, there's lots of reasons why. But one of the things I'll say in particular is there's something called point of care testing, also referred to as rapid testing, which is where you can take a little paddle and you swirl it around in between your lips and your gums. You put it in a test tube with some fluid, and it's like a pregnancy test, one line or two line, negative or positive. Most places in Canada, you don't have access to this technology. You don't have access to these kind of tests. You still take a blood draw, and then you wait 2 weeks, and then you don't. If you don't hear anything, it's negative. That's a terrible way to do things. Sex worker friends of mine have also said, you know, like, I can't wait 2 weeks to then go work again. Like, I need to know now. And we have the technology to know now. I just find it really bizarre. Like, I'm from Podunk, nowhere, Maine. Like, Sherbrooke is halfway between Boston and Sherbrooke, if that makes sense to people. I could get over-the-counter, like, I could go to the drugstore and buy a point-of-care test, or I could get a point-of-care test at the, like, low-income clinic that I used to go to. But then I moved to Montreal, and I couldn't get it. That's just like, whoa, this is super weird. So there is unevenness around what kind of access to medications you can get, what kind of access to testings you can get, depending on where you are provincially, and there are vast differences between the U.S. and Canada. So just to get the lay of the land.
And to speak maybe to the point of care testing, I was actually meeting with the Minister of Health just a few days ago, actually, to launch a new project across Canada that's looking at, you know, how we can work better with guys starting to guys across Canada to basically, you know, promote their health. And she didn't even know that point of care testing wasn't available from coast to coast. She actually, and the funny thing is, she always gets, so the Minister of Health always gets tested every year for World AIDS Day. And the theme this year was Know Your Status. So she got tested at our event with a point of care test. And when she asked, you know, so how do I go about accessing this? We had to have a conversation with her around, you know, how the actual province of where she comes from, which is New Brunswick, which is where I come from as well, you know, you can't access point of care testing anywhere. It's not even been approved yet by that province. So there's huge disparities from coast to coast, you know, when you move from one province to the next. And the sad thing about that is there is sometimes some leadership at a federal level, but what they can do is mainly just approve different testing methods, but they can't actually push onto the provinces what to approve and what not to approve. So then we need that, you know, provincial leadership, and elections, you know, come around every now and then we get the last one that we just had, and unfortunately then these kinds of things aren't at the forefront, right, of the conversations that our leaders want to have at this moment. So. So what I would say to that is think about these things when you're going to vote. they're very important.
Maybe one other observation as an American. the relationship between citizens and the states is very different. In the US, we all know the state's trying to kill us. If you're queer, if you're racialized, if you're poor, like, that's just the truth. Like, that is truth. You have to take my word for it if you don't believe it. In Canada, the relationship between citizens and the state looks a bit different because you actually have a healthcare system, for example, as the one major thing, and you have I guess there's an assumed benevolence to the state that, like, I just don't have because I grew up somewhere that's super poor and I just watched people die. And that doesn't happen here in the same way. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it looks different. Like, it's just a different context, a different environment. And here, I mean, I work at the Canadian AIDS Society, I volunteer at MACS, I'm involved in these civil society organizations, NGO, health organizations, but I see that difference where, you know, some of the organizations whose videos were shown are part of that NGO world, and some of them were activists, like they're grassroots activists, and I find a lot less grassroots activists doing work in Canada than I do people who are more professionalized or go into NGO world or some sort of like arm's length state institution. That, like, in the US, all that shit is crumbling. And people that's, I guess, maybe a big difference, I would say, between, like, what would a mid video look like that Max makes, because they're funded by the state, you know, where those groups are not. Or what would a video look like for the Canadian AIDS Society, who just did a film screening of Philadelphia and Toronto yesterday, sponsored by Coca-Cola, you know, like, not to harp on my place of employment, but it looks different here than it does in the U.S. For better or worse, it just means our strategies have to be different, and I think, yeah, it's more difficult to... The liberalism of Canada actually makes it more difficult to be an activist, I think, where in the U.S. it's just so obvious the response is activism because everyone's trying to kill you. Whereas here, that's not the same. So I offer that as the American that ran away 10 years ago.
I'd be curious to hear some more about, I guess, kind of intergenerational, like, what struck me about that set of videos is the kind of span of, you know, different ages of people who've been working in Mezzanapua, and yeah, and thinking about, like, what are the connections between those groups, how do those sort of legacies and knowledges, particularly from that kind of urgent activism that has to happen, like, what kind of transmission of knowledge or mentorship is happening between those organizations, and maybe here also,
I mean, we are in a particular moment of looking back. That's been pretty interesting. You know, when, like, an AIDS activist documentary is nominated for an Oscar, like it was with Not We Were Here, what's the other one? There's like six that came out at the same time. Anyways, United in Anger, We Were Here, How to Survive a Plague, that's the last thing you have that's nominated for an Oscar, right? So we are at a particular moment of this, like, looking back, and some people have, like, referred to this as, like, a, like, really stereotypical nostalgia, and have been really critical, including people have been really critical of me, because I'm interested in AIDS activist history. And so I think it's an interesting and somewhat delicate question to be thinking about intergenerationality and history. I mean, this is definitely just personal experience and anecdotal. I can't say this is, like, the truth, but I don't experience that here in the same way that I did in the States, where I actively sought out those relationships with older queers that were around. Like, I got really lucky. My first university professor was an old ACT UP Maine high fem dyke who is still a rad and still a Marxist and still doing cool things. So that, I think I got really lucky, and I sort of fell into it through that relationship. But in terms of, like, how do people connect with those types of people who are interested and willing to share, I don't know. And one of the questions for me around that is that there's actually a generation of people who are not here physically, and there's a generation of people who have a lot of difficulty going back to that time. It's like a time of mass trauma for a lot of people. So yeah, I think it's a really complicated and interesting question about, like, how do we build those relationships? And I find, so I'm 35, so right, I'm not old, but I'm not 20 years old anymore. And, you know, I was in high school in the 90s, late 90s, and I still remember parts of the AIDS crisis pre-treatment. And I find myself, before I was in Ottawa, I was teaching in university, and I taught an AIDS film and video course because that's what I wrote my dissertation on. And I was having relationships as the older person with people who were in their early 20s. And that was a really interesting experience for me because I never had that. I was from a small town, I was from central Maine, and either people had died or weren't interested because it was too difficult to talk about it. And so I learned a lot of things through movies, and that's why I ended up studying movies, I think. Moving image is a particularly useful way to be able to connect with things, or at least it was for me. So yeah, I don't know, I'm thinking about that question in reverse a little bit of, like, what does it mean for me to, like, be a holder of historical knowledge for younger people when I'm not that old? But it's because I've actively sought out those relationships, and some of those people have died since I've befriended those people. So yeah, I don't know. I think the movies are the answer in this funny way. So that's just my thoughts.
Could you say a bit more?
people were associating my work with this moment of like Emmy-nominated films. Like people thought I was making money, which is always very funny when people think you make money in the arts. So I made a film called Things Are Different Now. It's a short 6-minute Super 8 film, digitized and made in a composite with VHS cassette tapes that I dubbed of AIDS Community Television AIDS Community Television Public Access Television Series, and it included the ashes action, which someone mentions in the videos, where people went and actually tossed the ashes of their dead lovers onto the grounds of the White House. It's an incredibly powerful, brutal 30-minute episode of AIDS Community Television. And these things meant a lot to me and have meant a lot to me. And James Wensey, who you actually see briefly in the background in some of these clips, was my advisor when I was in art school. And he's the one that gave all these videotapes to me. And so I used them, and I had this very particular personal connection to this work. I made this film, and I guess you'd say I had good timing, because the AIDS revisitation moment started. This was around 2011. This is when these films started coming out. And so my work got sort of swept up with this other work that was happening that like I was oblivious to. I knew nothing about, because I'm not from New York City and I don't give a shit what happens in New York City. I'm like a country boy, and it's one of the problems I have with like queer history is all about New York City. AIDS activist history is all about New York City. And so I made this work, and then I was associated with all these other people, and I was told I was being nostalgic and avoiding the problems of the present, right? That the AIDS crisis isn't over and that things aren't different now, which I would argue they are different now. The crisis that we face today looks different. And so nostalgia was being wielded as like actually a tool to silence people that were making work like I was making, that are interested in history. I'm influenced by Marxist thought, and I understand this moment to be like the present we're living in is the, you know, it's all the events that have come before. This is how the moment we are in is we are in. A little bit of like historical materialism, right? Like the present is like, as soon as it's over, it's now the past. So I'm really interested in history because I think it allows us to understand the moment we are in and allows us to see how, who are historical enemies, who are historical allies, how might we position ourselves in the present by having historical knowledge of how we got to where we are today. So that was why I was making the work I was making. And the critique around nostalgia was like, oh, all these old gay white men are retelling a hero narrative about how they saved the world. And I don't think I was doing that, but that was the critique, and that's the critique that came out against We Were Here and How to Survive a Plague. Less so about United in Anger, as it took a more broad approach to AIDS activist documentary. It included women and it included people of color. And so yeah, that's how that happened. And there's the idea that anyone that pays any attention to the past is somehow nostalgic. Like, of course, I'm not nostalgic for pre-antiretroviral 1980s time frame. Like, that's ridiculous to say. But I am nostalgic for a sense of urgency. And I've been an AIDS activist for 15 years, and I'm just so fucking tired about how there's a million people at the Rideau Center Mall buying shit, and there's like 20 of us here, right? And I made the film about being depressed. It's really what I made that film about. And then nostalgia for urgency and people caring about things that I cared about. But somehow...
Nostalgia for militancy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and there's a theorist named Lucas Hildebrand who writes about this. He calls it retroactivism or prostalgia. Right? Like, so how are there positive uses of nostalgia, or how does looking back at past activism actually work to activate the present? And that's sort of where I situate myself, as opposed to telling the hero narrative about how, like, yeah, these men came together and like got antiretrovirals approved. Like I don't believe in that history or that narrative either. So to be placed in, I was placed in that category of people, and that's a bit disappointing.
Do you intend to follow up then to respond to that?
I mean, it was really brutal and personal, and I lost friendships over it. So, I don't know. I don't. There's a big poster that was came out of a campaign called "Your Nostalgia Is Killing Me," and it was aimed at me and a number of other people, and it got a lot of traction. And yeah, but I've had some conversations with some of the people that have said pretty hurtful things about me, and just gonna let it be what it was. Because I mean, they're wrong. So, you know, like, I think they totally misinterpret or misread my work.
Did that have anything to do with your move to Canada?
No, it actually happened right when I got here. Yeah, that's 2001.
Have you seen that film?
Was that critique from mostly from the US or?
No, it was actually mostly people from Toronto.
Okay. Yeah, figures.
Yeah. Were you going to say something?
No, I was going to say, I haven't seen that film, and being one of those old fart activists, and going back to that time and going, oh my God, I can't believe the shit we did, and how much we did, and how hard we worked, and how urgent the times were, and being ready to pass on the torch, right? I mean, that is the thing where the next generation comes in. It's like, you know, when you feel like the lack of urgency, there's a complacency that has set in that as me as an older activist has noticed too. At the same time, the interesting things that happened within the movement is that some of the people who are really, really engaged there and fought really hard there, and there was a lot of us women at the time doing that, and They weren't, like in Toronto at the time, there weren't any women contracting HIV at the time. That's not where the epidemic was. Then moved on into activism of other sorts, you know, as lesbians, you know, securing the reproductive rights of straight women and being over then at the Morgenthaler Clinic. So there is, within that urgency of activism, it has moved on. And I see a lot of these old activists now working in the indigenous valley, right? They're right now up at the pipelines. So there's this kind of fluidity that has kind of moved between causes rather than staying with the one cause because the powers that be told us that things were getting better kind of thing, right? So people let stuff go. But like seeing that film of yours, which also made me chuckle because there was a lot of tongue-in-cheek stuff in there.
There was.
Like, you know, the dream of, there's a line there, there's, you know, when I was grew up, the dream was to survive and not die of AIDS, and now the dream is, joining the military and having a white wedding. And I mean, you know, and within our queer community, things have changed too, and attitudes have changed. And yeah, and there's a lot of queers over there right now in the Beatles Center shopping. Yeah, getting their fashion consultation.
Which you can do, but you also have to do other stuff.
I might also just add also that, you know, we have this idea that this epidemic is over. And I think that's kind of a scary thought. Number one, because I think it feeds into that idea of complacency where, you know, we've reached a point now where we don't need to keep this movement.
No, exactly. But I mean, you know, for example, like being engaged in indigenous issues.
Totally.
The demographic has moved from the downtown
of Toronto.
Gay artist in Toronto to on reserve, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
totally.
where the epidemic has moved to.
Absolutely.
And that's where it's completely out of everybody's face. That's why a lot of people ignore it easily.
I agree. And I think there's also, again, like a lack of leadership, right, from people that do have the power within our country to actually promote these messages and tell us it's not over. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of people every year who are contracting HIV and aren't receiving the support they're supposed to be receiving. We have this amazing, you know, supposed goal of 90-90-90.
Yes.
And the reality of it is in Canada, that 90 is actually like a 70 and a 60 the further you move along the line. And like, what are happening to all these people that aren't, you know, connected to healthcare? that aren't staying within the healthcare systems that they need, and that aren't, you know, being even just diagnosed. Like, talking about New Brunswick, where I come from, we're seeing the highest rates coming out right now. Like, what is happening in New Brunswick right now? We don't have clinic care testing. We don't have access to any services, and yet we're saying, you know, this epidemic is over. So I think it's great, like, and you're right, right? The conversation is dying mostly because it's moving away from major urban centers, which is really sad. But at the same time, I think it's our job to also reignite these conversations and remind, you know, that our public health systems, that, you know, this is still here. Like, and we need your leadership to be able to provide the supports, you know, and the testing options to people so that we can actually reach, you know, our goals of elimination and support as well for those who are living with. So, what's my little, like, soapbox around the epidemic?
Maybe one more difference between the US and Canada to talk about too, and it might be changing, just thinking about how the epidemic looks different again. The US doesn't care if immigrants are HIV positive. Canada does. Canada has a ban on HIV positive immigrants. The US repealed their ban like 6 years ago under Obama. They also had one for a very
it's
long time.
It's coming back.
It will. Very good chance. But the framework of that is right that if you come into this country with an illness, a chronic, long-term illness, you're going to be a burden on the healthcare system and social services. And so currently, the limit is that if you're going to cost the healthcare system more than $6,680-something a year, so that's not just HIV, that's basically anyone with a disability can't immigrate to Canada through the economic class immigrant system, which is the express entry, which is how I came to this country. And that's how, right now, Canada's, in terms of the immigrants that are coming into Canada, it's over 70%. Last time I saw it was like 76% of immigrants last year were through the economic class immigrants. So that's not family reunification, that's not refugees, this is economic class immigrants. So the main immigrants coming into Canada, none of them can be HIV positive unless you are if you're a spouse of someone. That's the only way. If you're a child, no. If you're a parent, no. Like a parent of a child who is immigrated. So there's a case in Ottawa specifically where two former international students who got permanent residence went to sponsor their father and his new partner. So not their mother, but their father and his new wife. And the father found out he was HIV positive through the immigration process, because for people that don't know, there's mandatory testing of all immigrants coming into Canada, and they were denied. Like, he was not allowed to come to Canada, even though he has family here that are permanent residents of Canada. Currently, the Minister of Immigration, Refugee, Citizenship, Canada, has put in a provisional measure to increase the $6,000 limit by three, so it's around $18,000 right now, which could theoretically mean HIV positive people could come to this country. However, it depends on who is working at IRCC that day and who is the caseworker who gets your case, because the law has not changed. It's just been an instruction, like it's operational instruction from the minister. People have been working on this for a long time in Canada, particularly the HIV/AIDS Legal Network has been working on this for a long time. But it's a really awful situation for all people living with disabilities that might be trying to come here, because it sets up a situation where you're only measured for what you're going to cost society in terms of dollars, as opposed to like what someone with a disability can contribute. There's no balance. You're only looked at as a cost, not as a contributor. So there's also that to think about. And are the Liberals actually going to do it before they get kicked out of office? I don't know. Because it doesn't look good, right? Like, you don't want to look like you're bringing in immigrants, because that we already live in a pretty xenophobic country, right? Like, now we're going to be bringing in HIV-positive immigrants. Like, that's going to look really bad for the Liberals, so I don't actually think they're going to do it. Because they're spineless. So if there aren't any other questions, I don't want to hold people captive on a Saturday night.
You can go shopping now. Fashion consults.
Well, I just want to thank Saw, Nevin, Annette, Matt. Thanks for coming. And I also just wanted to acknowledge Ahmed was here from Canada. K1, which is the African Caribbean Black guys into guys group at Max, who actually had to step out early, but he was going to join us in the talk back. So that's too bad, but that's what happened. So